Natural Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Monday, April 25th, 2005, and we're here for a work session on the Department of Environmental Quality federal grant application request. The problem is we don't have a quorum, so we're going to enter into a public hearing on this bill. Can we do that because we haven't posted a public hearing?
I believe you can. You can start the work session. You can't take any action.
Okay, so we have to open a work session because we're posted for a work session. We're opening the work session on the Department of Environmental Quality federal grant application request. We are quickly approaching a quorum.
Would you let me vote twice, Chairperson?
Well, I would let you. It would be a matter of having Ramona down here with very short order.
She knows that kind of stuff.
Are you going to move something immediately?
We're going to move a grant request, but okay. We can't do it until we get another senator.
Right. I've got constituents outside the door. I'll be right outside the door as soon as the senator comes in.
And if you leave me...
I promise you I won't. I promise.
Good, because
we don't need him anyway.
You don't need him. We got two of them.
Get out of here.
Hey. Integrate to be loved, folks.
With that, Mr. Siebert, please set the stage for us.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, you have in front of you a request to apply for a federal grant by the Department of Environmental Quality. The grant application would be to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for a pilot project to demonstrate compliance with environmental regulations in a particular sector, and that would be the auto repair sector, and it would be a self-certification basis. And I believe someone from the department is here to describe the pilot program proposal in more depth and answer any questions.
Please come forward. And our able BAM analyst. You get to talk until another senator shows up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alan Kippett. I'm the Land Quality Administrator for the Department of Environmental Quality, and I'm here today requesting your permission to apply for the $200,000 grant to EPA. This grant would be used for a pilot project to assist, Mr. Siebert said, the automotive trade industries. It's designed and modeled after successful programs in other states to develop some tools to be used by the industry for self-certification and reporting back to DEQ. There's no match required on this grant. It's a three-year grant cycle. And while there is no match required, the department is looking at allocating some of our hazardous waste resources toward this program to facilitate the technical assistance side of it. And if you have any questions, I'd be certainly happy to answer them.
Questions or comments?
Since we've got a moment, Madam Chair.
Yeah, how about it?
What kind of environmental difficulties do auto repair, when you're talking about lead disposal or something, mercury disposal?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, automotive repair industry folks have a number of chemicals and solvents that are used in their industry, and so this is to provide them with a checklist and some basic information they can use to deal with those chemicals more properly.
Any more questions?
No, I'm trying.
Should I
elaborate
more?
Senator Frazier to come down, maybe?
That's an idea.
I know he's in the building. Senator Shields is out for medical reasons, and he'll not be here for most of the meeting.
Schrader,
see if he's available real quick. I know he's in the building getting car run down. He might be over in LFO. Just look for
him. Is Schrader in LFO?
Senator Nelson's on his way.
Nelson's on his way.
You've got to call Nelson anyway.
Yep. Schrader can step in and give us a quorum.
And then we can just leave crap out in the hall.
Do you have any Republican senator to vote yes? Yeah, you do.
Okay.
You gotta have Nelson.
We have a Republican. Yeah, you're right. You have to have a majority of each party, each side.
I think it's just. Is it each party side? No, I think it's just each side.
No,
I don't need a Republican. No, I don't. No. Nice try. I don't need no Republican.
Two,
I need another. Anybody over
here.
Here.
We'll be fine.
I'll
watch you.
So we just get with this, and then does it go to full?
Mm-hmm.
So we have to make a recommendation to full.
Okay.
Accept that. Okay. You want to go trolling for senators out there? See if you can come up with them?
Schrader or Nelson, either one.
Okay.
Assuming Nelson's a yes. Got me, Wayne.
From the Department of Environmental Quality,
Okay.
Which we all think is a wonderful idea, and we
I
really
think it's
hope you do too. I would accept a motion to do you want to do a legislative fiscal office?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, legislative fiscal office is recommending approval of the request.
Thank you. I would accept a motion to accept the legislative fiscal office recommendation and move this to full committee with a do-pass recommendation.
The Senate would like to move that. And I personally will move it, too.
I have the motion. Is there a discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion is carried. We'll close the work session on the Department of Environmental Quality Federal Grant Application Request and open a public hearing on House Bills 5003 and 5004. The budget bill and the fee bill for the Department of Agriculture, and welcome back the same BAM analyst and a different agency. Would you like to do that right now? Okay, we can hide some.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We are in the second day of our overview of the Governor's recommended budget. And just to refresh your memory, we were going over the three policy areas within the agency, the divisions and programs within those policy areas. We finished the economic development policy area on Thursday, started in on the food safety and consumer protection policy area, and moved through the food safety programs on Thursday, and now we're starting the second division within food safety and consumer protection. Before I get into the detail again, one of the points that I wanted to make on Thursday and forgot to do so is you'll notice that we've got policy areas, divisions within policy areas, programs within divisions, but the nature of our work is not limited to just the programs within a particular policy area supporting that policy area only. And let me give you just an example of that. Our plant division, which is in the natural resources policy area, certainly helps with the protection of the natural resources base in Oregon, but it also plays a very key role in our economic development functions. So from a budget perspective, we've got to put things in boxes, but in terms of how we view our programs in the agency, very fluid, very interrelated, and very connected with multiple policies that we carry out in the agency. The Animal Health and Identification Division is another example of that. It's in the Food Safety and Consumer Protection Policy Area. Certainly contributes very importantly to health, public health issues, but also very importantly to economic issues for the industry. Within the division, we have the Animal Health Services Program, and this is the program that tries to keep animal diseases out of the state, or if we do have an outbreak within the state, to control and eradicate that disease very quickly. This is the program that was the primary responder when we had the incidents of BSE and the work that we did in Oregon to follow up with that single case that was identified in Washington State. We also have the Animal Identification and Brands Program, and this is the classic registering of brands for livestock owners and tracking those brands through sales, and the use of that program for preventing livestock theft. One of the interesting things to note, when we have an increase in prices for livestock, the recent increase in cattle prices, we also see a rising incidence of cattle theft that we've been involved in. The feed program within this division ensures livestock feeds meet nutritional and labeling standards.
Senator Bates has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is livestock theft a significant factor in the industry? Does it really impact people heavily?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, yes, it does. We have individuals that steal animals and sell them to make money.
Follow up.
Enforcement side has changed somewhat.
Okay. Not my part of the country. Hang them. Seriously. How do they move beef cattle through the market? I mean, our local auctions, we check our brands pretty carefully. We know where that cattle came from for the most part. How do these people move these animals through the market?
Why don't I have our administrator of our division, Roger Huffman, come up, and he can tell you a little bit about how that program works.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Huffman, administrator of the Division of Animal Health and Identification for the Department of Agriculture. And as far as the brand inspections program, I guess there's a basic four places or events where a brand inspection is required. One is when animals are slaughtered. One is prior to them leaving the state on horses and cattle. And again, on slaughterous horses and cattle. Change of ownership on cattle only, not on horses. And through the sale yards, as you mentioned, is the other thing on horses and cattle. We look at, it averages about 1.2 million cattle and about 16 to 17,000 horses a year that we inspect for ownership. And so you bring it in and we confirm that you either are or should be the rightful owner and allow that sale. And if we don't think you are, then there's multiple things that we can do to, at that time, up to a seizure of the animal. And
well, are you thinking using chip technology? Can you put a chip in the ear? Is that too expensive?
Madam Chair and Senator Bates, the chip, the implanting of chips actually has not been approved by FDA because they feel that it could be an adulterant to the human food side. So on cattle, they haven't allowed that. On horses, there has been some in the nuchal ligament. It's kind of went in waves, but interestingly, the National Identification National ID program is looked at right now as being adopted. They're talking about a mandatory program by 2009, which could, if it followed the direction that most people are pointing towards, each animal, at least each livestock animal in the United States, would have electronic or RFID device on them. But it's generally a button tag and not a implanted. Yes. But ironically, they, in order to sell that to the health animal health industry, they will not allow us to tap into that for theft purposes or ownership purposes. It's only for disease trace back.
So you'll be able to know, I mean, that kind of bumps us up to the Animal Health Services Program. You'll have information on there about where the animal originated, but you can't use that for theft purposes. You can only use that for disease control purposes.
Madam Chair, make sure clarification on the National ID Program that's being proposed, that would be the only purpose. It would have to be a major disease event, and then only animal health officials could tap into that repository. But as far as the brands program, the brand inspection system, we freely use that information when there's a disease issue. The brand inspection program is actually very crucial and critical to the tracking of animals and their ownership through time. So it's used both ways, animal health and brands, right now in the current state programs.
Why? Why not law enforcement? I mean, what's the argument against using it for theft and for law enforcement using this technology? I know you don't speak for them, but you must have heard what their argument is.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Schaffer, the biggest concern when the Bill Hawks from USDA went around and had listening sessions around the United States one of the primary concerns were the issue of confidentiality and would this information potentially get out into hands that people wouldn't want it for, and or frankly the government, they don't want the government to be able to have people that they don't want, other government agencies to be able to use that for other purposes.
Well, I'll just let it end there, but it don't make a lick of sense to me. So hopefully somebody listening will come explain it to me at length. Thank
Senator
you.
Nelson.
So you got all these checkpoints. How do the wrestlers actually circumvent them? And then how big of a problem is it?
Senator Nelson, there's the size of the programs Katie alluded to is sometimes dependent on the cattle market itself. Most of the thefts actually occur on unbranded animals and primarily the calves. It's the calves missing. And in some circumstances, it's nearly impossible to have all cows calved out by the time you turn them out on open range. Therefore, you're going to have some that are out there running around with no brands, and that's just kind of an open invitation to people to steal those. And then there's others, again, where they're commingled and people are intentionally pulling them off, rebranding them, moving them out of state, because there are other states that have weaker programs. So once they get out of state, in some cases, it's fairly easy to market those animals.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crook.
Thank you. I was back in D.C. Week before last. As part of the NCSL Ag Committee, this particular issue, we got a briefing from USDA on the system. And Roger's quite correct. It's the security and confidentiality concerns that are driving the issue of only using this for this purpose and why it's not going to be made available, at least in any foreseeable time for law enforcement, which I understand their reasonings. I'm not sure I totally agree with it, but it's an interesting direction to see and to utilize the technology too, by the way, is radio frequency ear tags as opposed to microchips, which have been the rage. The problem with microchips are they migrate all over an animal's body, and you part of this system, the way it's going to be set up, is to make it easily usable everywhere at each stage, because every time an animal's sold, every time it's moved, at various points in its life, it's going to be tracked. And so you need to be able to have these readers so you can swipe it in the same spot on the animal, and everybody knows where you do that. Well, it's easy if you've got an ear tag, but if you've got a microchip that's floating all over an animal's body, wouldn't work very well, and that's why they chose to go with radio frequency, which I found fascinating, because that's actually old technology. But it turns out to be the most convenient and reliable way of making this system work. Which, interesting, this will also work with COOL, which is country of origin or origin labeling. Even though they're supposed to be independent, one will lead to the other, frankly, in terms of that. This is, of course, the traceback issue is very important, not only because of mad cow, but also so many of our trading partners. In Japan, I went with a trip with ODA some years ago to Japan, and that issue of absolute identification of food sources to ensure that it is what they say it is and what they want is the reason they're spending billions and billions of dollars, U.S. dollars, in Japan over these issues.
Why couldn't you just reprogram the radio frequency tag if you were wanting to steal cattle and just program it to say that it was your cow?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't have an answer for that. I assume that the technology is such that let me back up. Each animal has a kind of a barcode that's associated with that radio frequency. And apparently there are enough variations in the frequency that they only use it once, if I remember right. Does that sound right, Roger?
Well,
each frequency is unique to the animal?
Chair Morgan, actually the transponders themselves are passive. They don't have a battery, so they're not programmable. The number is encrypted on that, and it isn't alterable or changeable. You may be able to, in some studies, make that where it's not readable, but you wouldn't be able to assign a new number to it. And ironically, as you're mentioning, even if you wanted to change it for ownership purposes, it wouldn't do you any good because we wouldn't be able to access the system, go and find out if it was yours or not.
Let's move on here. Ms. Koba, please take it away.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Madam Chair. The fourth program in this division is the Predator Control Program. The state provides resources which are then coupled with federal funds and local funds in counties that choose to participate in the Predator Control Program for controlling pet predators. So this is basically pass-through money through our agency for that purpose.
Representative Krieger has a question.
Madam Chair, regarding the predator thing, I just had the pleasure of writing my $350 check to Predator Control yesterday, which he's supposed to be picking up off my door, being I'm not home. And I just want to make sure we have a record that Department of Fish and Wildlife has a program, you have a program, but you work with the same people?
The federal
control agency. And there is, I believe, some testimony that will come in that, I think they said on the conservative side it was $11 million, and I laughed at that because it's $11 million in Curry County alone, not counting the rest of the counties. And I do have my $400,000 worth of loss since 1995 on my property, so it's huge, and we need to address it better than what we are. And that's why, and it's not the problem with the predators, that we need to be managing natural resources with not at the ballot box. And that's what we've done with cougar and bear both.
In terms of budget drivers, key issues, and environmental factors for this program area, obviously we just spoke about the development of the National Identification Program, and we are working with producers to right now register premises under that program. The continued need to monitor and exclude animal diseases, and I think I mentioned last Thursday the impact of globalization on a lot of what we do. This is a classic area in terms of the more rapid movement of diseases because of movement of animals and other things. So these are just a few of the diseases that we keep a lookout for and don't want to have established in Oregon. Huge economic loss with disease in the livestock industry. And the third area, we also participate with biosecurity and homeland security issues around food system preparedness, the concern about the purposeful introduction of a disease to cause chaos and economic damage is one of the areas that obviously we're concerned about.
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to disease, are you looking at the production of virulent forms of E. coli and bacteria that type that can be developed in cattle and brought to the consumer, especially in feedlots with using antibiotics? I mean, are you looking for those too?
Madam Chair, we'll bring Roger back up.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, actually, on that particular issue, we don't do a lot of work on the that really kind of falls into the food safety, human safety, and food side of it.
Okay.
Thanks. With reference to avian influenza, I was reading a really interesting article about how that has really changed the way that ducks and geese and fowl are raised in Southeast Asia and China. Are we looking at that becoming more of an issue for us too? Has it been showing up on the North American continent at all?
Madam Chair, yes. Avian influenza has an exotic Newcastle disease are really the two poultry diseases that have kind of shown up in the United States in the last several years. But on the avian influenza, mostly that's been on the East Coast. in those states on the east side of the United States. And exotic Newcastle outbreak was in California about 2 years ago. And that was a significant event. There was something like $135 million spent to eradicate that. We were very nervous about it coming up here. So we did a lot of preventative measures with those people that move birds in those markets, because it was backyard flocks that were infected.
So did those flocks get infected because of the Asian issue, or is this something that just spontaneously boils up from time to time?
Madam Chair, we don't believe that there was a direct connection from an Asian connection to those avian influenza outbreaks.
Okay.
Thanks. I think we're done now.
The next division that we'd like to talk about is the Measures and Standards Division. This is the division that deals with device accuracy assurance. And this is the program that ensures that all weighing and measuring devices used in commerce are accurate, including motor fuel metering devices. We have our motor fuel quality program within this division. Our metrology laboratory, which provides official mass, volume, and length standards, calibrations for businesses, scientific institutions, and regulatory agencies. We have the set of standards, which everything is then based off of. And finally, we spoke a little bit about the package product verification program in phase one. This is the program that almost all of the funds, the general fund, were cut from the program. We have a little bit left where we can go out and do some sample work to see if we believe there's some areas of fraud, and then we can follow up with those stores and work in that area. But this was the case of the most recent issue with one of the major grocery stores and some meat weight issues. In terms of budget drivers, key issues and environmental factors, certainly the increase in number and I think even more importantly the technological complexity of weighing and measuring devices means we need to stay on top in terms of knowledge of these systems and the ability to make sure that they are indeed accurate. Online e-commerce and how to ensure fairness of transactions if based on weight or volume, that's currently not done. It's something that we're keeping our eye on, and there's discussions at the federal level. Increased use and testing needs for biofuels, and certainly if we can get the biofuels package through, that could speed this up, but this is going to be an issue that we're going to need to deal with as biofuels become more and more common in the marketplace. And finally, the issues I mentioned in terms of funding for a package product program.
Representative Schaffner.
Thank you. What kind of timeline are we looking at? If everything fell into place perfectly, when would we be shucking out biofuels?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffer, we might look to one of the experts of your colleagues here in the building who spend a ton of time on this issue, and Representative Krupp. Or we could bring Brent up and respond as well.
I'll just take a quick stab at it, Madam Chair. Some biofuels can be produced today from waste grease out of restaurants, animal rendering, slaughterhouses, those animal fats, those types of things. So as soon as the facility actually gets built, probably fall at the very earliest, more likely going to be the beginning of the year. So likely, beginning of 06, there would probably be a need for a small amount of testing on the part of the department to be involved. The following, later that year, later in the crop year of 06, would be likely where you would see a lot more need for their services, because farmers would be planting crops, foresters would be harvesting timber waste and cleaning up forests and converting that to biofuels once those facilities get built, and that's not likely going to be until middle part, the end of 06. So the demands, I think, on the agency would really be significant in the latter part of 06, and then from there probably grow, my guess.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bates.
A question along the same line, if I could. When gas is 3 1/4 a gallon this summer, we'll be looking at these things. Kidding. But it's not going to go down. I've talked to some local people about this. There's concerns about biofuels, especially biodiesel, from the point of view of losing your guarantee on your engine when you buy a new diesel, and questions that they've asked about being sure what you're buying when you buy a biodiesel fuel. What are your plans for, one, monitoring biodiesel, making sure that what you're getting is what you're paying for? And secondly, do you have any answer, or have you looked at when people buy diesel engines for their cars or trucks, that they don't lose their warranty on their engine?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I know the second issue that you're referring to came up in the testimony that was received by the committee. We don't get involved in terms of dealing with this warranty issue, and I don't know, Representative Krupp, if you've heard if this has been an issue in other states. I know the rail locomotive industry came forward.
Madam Chair, the truck engine manufacturers specifically are very concerned that biodiesel meets ASTM standards minimum for blending use. So in other words, every farmer or co-op biodiesel processing facility or private processing facility would have to meet the minimum ASTM standards for engine warranties to be valid. And I think all of the engine manufacturers are now basically making those statements, because this issue is becoming more prevalent throughout the states. That then means that who's going to assure that those standards are being met? Well, you're looking at them. And so it is a very, very important issue. And I know the trucking industry has talked with us at length on this issue. It's very important to them. I know farm equipment manufacturers, John Deere specifically, is also very interested to make sure that they anticipate a lot of their farmers in the future are going to be burning their own diesel that they've produced themselves, biodiesel. They want to make sure that it's to a certain standard. So I think you're going to see this continue to be an area of concern that these folks are going to have to certify.
Well, and I'm sure that if the bill gets assigned to our subcommittee, we can have a very long and deep conversation about these things, too.
I'm also very interested in this, Madam Chair.
But Madam Chair, Senator Bates, back to the first part of your question, it would be our program that would test and make sure that the product is indeed meeting the standards.
Please proceed.
Our lab services division falls in this policy area, but it truly serves all divisions within the agency. We do the sampling and testing for food and dairy products, biotechnology, pesticide and fertilizers, shellfish testing, chemistry, export services testing, and the Food Emergency Response Network. We are a FERN-approved lab within our lab division. Moving on then to the final policy area, our natural resources protection policy area, and our first division here is our natural resources division. Within this division, we have the following programs: our water quality program, which is basically the implementation of Senate Bill 1010, our confined animal feeding operations program, working with those operations that have confined animals and making sure they're handling their waste properly. The work that we do here with our soil and water conservation districts, they're basically the local on-the-ground hands for implementing many of the projects to help meet water quality standards in the state. Smoke management program, in terms of registering and notifying farmers when they can indeed burn fields. Shellfish plat leasing program, and then obviously we get involved with land use issues and spend a lot of time on that topic lately, needless to say. In terms of budget drivers, key issues, and environmental factors, the federal government just recently passed new CAFO regulations, increasing the number and complexity of the permits. We've been working closely with the industry to bring them up to speed and be in compliance with these federal regulations. Industry is doing a great job. Oregon is one of the leading states in the United States in terms of moving along with these new regulations. The ongoing implementation, monitoring, and enforcement of the Senate Bill 1010 agricultural water quality plans. Again, we're seeing some good progress, I think, out on the ground. We have all of the basins plans have now been adopted through rule, so we're completely in the middle of implementation and hope through our performance measures to be able to start showing improvements in water quality. Soil and Water Conservation District's capacity to provide education and technical assistance to landowners. We're hearing that there's a great demand for that technical assistance and resources that we can get at the federal and the limited amount of resources available at the state level, and just trying to get as much as that of that as we can down to the ground and making sure our SWCDs are have the ability themselves, the staffing, to work with the industry to do projects on the ground. Environmental challenges and litigation in terms of a whole host of issues, something that we pay a lot of attention to and very much involved in ballot measure 37 and where that may go.
How many claims does Department of Ag have claims from ballot measure 37?
Madam Chair, the department has received no ballot measure 37 claims. The vast majority of those claims have gone to Department of Land Conservation and Development, and the vast majority deal with a dwelling subdivision on agricultural land.
So what would be an example of a type of claim that your agency would get rather than DLCD?
Madam Chair, we don't regulate or protect farmland, if you will. We could, for example, receive a claim perhaps dealing with agricultural water quality plans if... as part of that, riparian areas are put in place and a landowner claims that he's lost value in his land because of that. That could be a type of a claim that could come to us, but again, we have not received any claims within the agency. So it would be a regulatory program that we have that a claimant would say has reduced the value of their property. Our plant division, if you'll remember from last week, this is the largest division now. Plant and natural resources, the two largest divisions within the agency. In this division, we have our insect pest prevention and management program, and just as we talked about animal diseases, plant and insect diseases are a big deal for us, and I think will continue to remain, if not grow, in terms of their importance or potential threat to the economy. And this is just not the agricultural economy in the state. Certainly, if you remember the gypsy moth outbreak 20 years ago in Lane County and the devastating impact that had on the timber economy. So gypsy moth, Japanese beetle, cereal leaf beetle, invasive insects, we don't want them. And if we find them, we want to get rid of them before they become established. In terms of the health plant health program, perhaps the most notable during this last or current biennium, it was the outbreak of sudden oak death disease in the nursery industry here in Oregon. We had it in the wild down in Curry County, but had it spread into the nursery industry, and so we worked very closely with the industry, developed a certification program, quickly moved to certify all nurseries in the state. That ultimately became the basis for the federal plan that was adopted in terms of certification being required for California, Oregon, and Washington nurseries before they can ship product out of state. So the industry worked very closely with us, and despite the fact that we have the disease, I think it's been a remarkable response, and hopefully we can keep it at a minimum or even eradicate it within our nursery industry.
Have you found any outbreaks in private nurseries this spring at all?
Madam Chair, we are going through and through the nurseries this spring. We're about probably over halfway through now. Madam Chair, 70% through certification this year, and I believe just two nurseries were identified as having sudden oak death. Very small nurseries, and we were able to move quickly and isolate plant material and wasn't as big a deal as some of our other issues we've had to deal with in nurseries. So keep our fingers crossed that that's it this year as we continue through.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you're looking at insect pests like gypsy moth, Japanese beetle, isn't Japanese beetle primarily in in forests. Is there an overlap here between you and the forest industry in nursery programs or Christmas tree programs? Why does the overlap occur here?
I always like to take the opportunity, Madam Chair, to bring up the real experts who could talk to you all day, Senator Bates, about bug diseases. This is Dan Hilber in our Administrative Plant Division.
My name's Dan Hilber, and I'm Administrator of the Plant Division for the Department of Ag. Senator Bates, Japanese beetle is not a forest pest. It's a pest of golf courses, grass, sod production, grass seed, but also fruits, vegetables, flowers. It has a wide host range. And the general division between Department of Ag and Department of Forestry pests is that we deal with ones that are not native. So a new pest to the forest, like gypsy moth, we would deal with. But a pest that is native to the forest, like western spruce budworm, we don't deal with that. That's a forestry department issue.
So does the same thing apply to sudden oak death, because you've got infestations in the forest too?
Exactly. If it's an exotic disease, then it's Department of Ag. We've got the regulatory authority to enact quarantines and take eradicative action. But if it's a native disease, then we don't deal with it, and the Department of Forestry does.
Let me just ask one more. So the sudden oak death that is in the forest down in Wayne's neck of the woods, what's going on with that infestation? Is that being contained successfully?
Madam Chair, we first found it in 2001, and the first year we found it, we clear-cut and burned 40 acres of the woodlands down there. Every year since, we found a little more, but less than the year before. So we really feel good that we're making progress on it. And this spring so far, we've only found two trees.
Senator Schaffer.
Thank you. The native pest, whatever that worm was you said. So I'd imagine we try to eradicate it, but then doesn't it become endangered? I'm dead serious here, too.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffer, no. Native pests, we never try to eradicate native pests. Those are control programs where you're trying to protect the value of the timber, or you've got some other goal in mind. But we don't ever try to eradicate native pests.
I thought, and I am serious, because it's how bizarre this world has become. And I'm jumping ahead, but are you going to talk to the snails? The rivers are state lands and the threatened and endangered. There was an article in the paper this weekend about some snails now that are going to be maybe put on the list. I'm jumping ahead a couple more.
And Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, the threatened and endangered plant program is only for plant species that we deal with, so we don't deal with snails in terms of that perspective. But we've got some snails that are invasive snails that are not good.
European brown garden snail is a good example of that, where it's a nursery pest, a pest in orchards, and the state is relatively free of it, although you can find it on the coast. There's a neighborhood in Eugene that has it. There's a neighborhood in Albany that has it. And the Department of Human Resources in the bed on the street that goes next to there, is it Marion Street or something, has a persistent problem with that. Those plants no doubt came from California. Whenever we find them there, we have the groundspeople treat them. But basically, the Willamette Valley, our nursery agriculture areas are free of that snail, and we work very hard to keep it that way.
I have a large population of some kind of snails in my own garden that I'm working very hard to control right now.
Madam Chair, we'll continue on. I think I'll just have Dan stay in case there are other questions as we proceed. We have the nursery and Christmas tree program within this division, which does all the inspections for shipment of and issuing phytosanitary certificates for shipment of nursery and Christmas trees. And certainly for us, as we get into the Thanksgiving season, we have people that are out, you know, just as busy as those in the Christmas tree industry, making sure we get them their proper paperwork so they can move their product to market. The noxious weed control program is within this division, and just as with bugs and diseases. We don't want noxious weeds in our state. Unfortunately, we do have noxious weeds in the state, and so we have programs to try to eradicate those weeds where we think we still have a chance to do that. Threatened and Endangered Plant Program, the statutory authority rests within the Department of Ag to manage threatened and endangered plants on state lands. That's a program where the funding was cut during the last legislative session, and we have a package that would restore that funding before you in this budget. And the Plant Division, the Department of Agriculture, is a charter member of the Invasive Species Council. This is the group that develops the list of 100 bad plants, pests, bugs that we're using in our performance measure as we monitor the performance of our program. In terms of budget drivers, key issues, and environmental factors, again, global trade is what is moving plants, plant diseases, bugs that we don't want, and so we will continue to see this be a major issue for our industry and for the state. Biosecurity concerns as well in this area. Our aggressive work with the industry to eradicate sudden oak death from the state of Oregon or any other diseases that could attempt to establish themselves here. One of the issues Representative Krupp is very familiar with, we have the authority to establish control districts to assist in crop diversification and separation. So we can basically delineate a place where we wouldn't allow a certain crop to be grown. This is going to be a big issue for us in the coming year as we deal with the conflict between canola growers and the specialty seed industry, particularly in the valley. Canola spreads diseases to such products as broccoli and cauliflower, and the specialty seed industry is very concerned about the potential production of canola in the valley. So we've already established an advisory group to the agency to talk about identifying control districts where canola could or could not be grown in the state. But we've also used control districts and quarantines for other disease issues. We established a control district in eastern Oregon for a trial of Roundup Ready bentgrass. So it was only allowed to be grown in that particular area. So this is a tool that we think is probably going to get more and more attention as we deal with some of these issues.
Senator Schaffer has a question.
Thank you. Right there, would Measure 37, could it jump up?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffer, yes.
All right. Thank you.
And finally, as I mentioned, the funding for...
Senator Bates.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The discussion about GMOs is going to be heating up hotter and hotter as time goes along. Europe is getting ready to ban them, I believe, or going back and forth on it. What are you doing to control the use of GMO crops in Oregon?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, once the issue of a GMO crop is regulated at the federal level, so in terms of trials, the feds would monitor a trial of a GMO crop. Once that has been deregulated, there is no requirement to monitor where those crops or seeds are planted. So if it's a deregulated crop, and canola is an example, I think 75% estimated of canola is now GMO. That's grown in the world. Soybeans is another crop that has a high amount of GMO. Farmers buy it, they plant it. There's no reporting requirement to anyone about what kind of product they're using. For product that is shipped to markets that do not allow GMO, we do get involved in testing for a product. If a producer or a processor has a product, we can test to see if there is GMO in that product, and so they can know before they ship the product overseas that it is indeed free of GMO.
What if you have two farmers, and this may never occur, but or maybe occurring now, one is trying to do non-GMO foods, wants to ship, guy next door has GMO foods or crop, and maybe the same species, there's some cross-fertilization that can occur. How do you deal with that? Do they come to you and say, what's going on?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, it is an issue. They don't come to us. Basically, that becomes could potentially become a litigation issue if one person, a grower, wanted to sue another grower for a drift of GMO into their production. I can't remember off the top of my head if there's been a court case that cut and dried sweet corn to sweet corn. Certainly, I think we're going to see that in the future, but it basically comes down to a liability issue, and we certainly deal with it in terms of pesticide and pesticide drift through our pesticide program, which we'll get to in a minute. But right now, we haven't gotten into a place where we get in the middle of trying to resolve those issues. Now, if we have set up a control district in terms of a GMO product, then that will be another issue that we're going to have to deal with.
Well, I assume the industry then hasn't come to you and asked for regulations concerning this to help relieve conflicts. This is something just kind of happening out there right now.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, that's correct. But we're certainly in conversations with folks, and something could develop.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Shawson.
Thank you. Genetically, the definition of genetically modified, I mean, hybrid seed corn has big roots in Iowa where I grew up. But they did it in the field, not so much the laboratory. Does this mean in the laboratory or any kind of genetic modification?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, from a not an expert perspective, basically a GMO product means where you have taken a gene from a plant and inserted it into another plant. So this is something that could not happen in the field.
Correct me if I'm wrong, it can be cross-species. Okay. It can be different species of plant, or even at times from bacteria into a plant. And I think that's correct, if I'm right. Yeah. So it could be a pretty tremendous achievement after you do it, but also something makes you think twice about what are you doing here, transferring genetic material from different species that normally could never, ever have that happen. So it's a huge change. We're not sure of all the repercussions, or none. The debate is huge.
Like a Republican and a Democrat?
No.
Forgive me.
So my genetic material is shared occasionally, but it's, you know.
This genetic modified issue, it's an old issue, though, isn't it? I mean, in the wheat industry did it in the 1940s and 50s, and they genetically modify the wheat into the Gaines wheat. I mean, that's 40 or 50 years old, isn't it? It's not as though we're talking about this as being something new, but I think if you alter it, this has been around for a long time.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, what you're talking about is the breeding programs that used to be done basically in the field, or a lot of it was sort of artificially enhanced, but it wasn't species to species back then. And Katie's right, things have changed now because there are new techniques where you can get genes from one organism that you could never mate with another organism into that organism using these modern techniques. So things have changed in the last 10 or 20 years.
Like the Gaines wheat, wasn't that a genetically modified wheat?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that particular variety.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, we can go back and see if we can clarify.
I know it is because they used to raise, they got a 30 bushel crop, that was a wonderful crop, but Homestead down here at Oregon State University 40 years ago put these two things together and all of a sudden have Gaines wheat and we were raising 60, 70 bushels where you used to raise 30 bushels. That's probably 30 or 40 years old.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I don't think that was actually a gene inserting. It was a hybrid kind of effort, but we will go back and double check.
Senator Bates.
Yeah, I think the difference here is kind of dramatic. I mean, you can argue that for 10,000 years we've been playing with the gene pool inside a species, or 6,000, depending on what your background is, trying to breed, whether it be cattle or wheat or anything else. What's different here is we now can go inside the chromosome, lift up the genetic material of one species, even an animal species, and insert that into a plant species. If we want that specific gene to speak to that new species. That's difference, and that's a huge difference there, and that's why where people are wondering where we're going with this.
And Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I mean, for example, in soybeans and canola, the primary use has been either for disease resistance So the flip side is then you need less chemicals, pesticides to control disease. You can do it that way, better for the environment, as well as the whole Roundup Ready notion, which I think is the most prevalent in terms of inserting the genes so that you can spray out a field with Roundup but not and kill the weeds but not kill the crop. But there, you're right. The questions are many questions about, is this fine in the long run, or is it going to result in something unintended that...
Well, moving along with the Department of Ag budget.
The reason I brought the conversation is I think it's an area that they may have to get involved in someday.
And that's why we put it on our list.
Yeah, you may be asked to regulate.
The next division is our pesticides division, and this is the division where we manage our pesticide-based program, so we license and train pesticide users, compliance monitoring and investigations. If we receive a complaint about pesticide used inappropriately, and we also register all pesticides that are used in the state. Fertilizer program, where we review fertilizer, test and sample fertilizer for product content and labeling requirements.
There was an issue last biennium and the biennium before in the fertilizer program around the heavy metals that were in those products. What's going on with that?
Madam Chair, we'll bring someone up who can answer. Someone is.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Assistant Director with the Department of Agriculture. I believe it was in the 2001 legislative session, the fertilizer program was revamped. And following that, the agency set standards for certain components of fertilizers, some metals being one of them. We have used some of the Fertilizer Research Fund that was available, and we have ongoing research looking specifically at how those components are interacting with plants in terms of uptake and ground and surface waters.
So are you seeing any, within the fertilizer products itself, are you seeing any decrease in the unsafe practices and increases in product safety there because of the work that you've been doing?
Madam Chair, I'd have to get back with you in terms of practices. I know in terms of product registrations, there are some products that do not meet the standards for registration in the state of Oregon, and I can get you numbers for those if you would like me to bring those back to you.
Something that we could discuss in the third phase. I think
sure.
It would be a performance measure type issue.
We'll be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Thank you. A couple of questions on pesticide use reporting. This is something I'm still learning a lot about. How often do you actually get complaints on pesticide use? Is that pretty rare to get a complaint?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, pesticide use reporting is the PERS program, which
you mentioned a few minutes ago about pesticide use and you handle complaints.
Right.
But you often get complaints.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I just wanted to clarify.
Together, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I used the wrong phrase.
That's not the pesticide use reporting system.
I'm sorry,
in our base program, yes, we do receive complaints and conduct investigations. And I would say on average, maybe once a month, once every couple of months, I'm 300 complaints a year. This is one of the questions I think that was asked in phase one, and we provided response. We may have that in your response packet in terms of complaints, investigations, outcome of investigations.
How serious are those complaints? Do they really strike you as something that's, I mean, is it sort of a worried person, something happened, I'm not sure what it was, or are they some of them actually serious?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, some of them are serious, and we do issue civil penalties for pesticide use violations.
Representative Schaffler?
I'd imagine it isn't just farmers and ranchers. It could be the local government spraying the ditch or somebody out in their yard.
ODOT.
Is that, ODOT? Or is it strictly, are those 300-some strictly agriculturally related?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I'm going to take a stab at this, But we have somebody from the pesticides division that will throw something at me, I'm sure, if I get it wrong. Those pesticide complaints can come in from commercial pesticide users in urban and agricultural settings. They can be in terms of use by public entities as well. So it's a wide variety of pesticide uses across the board. So not to focus only on agriculture and forestry. Did I get it right?
Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. There's an executive summary that basically you've handed this out. All this information is here. This thing shows the case there's been one fatality in intentional digestion of the insecticide. That was in 19 or 2001. The year before, there was one fatality involved with pesticides, and that was when the spray pilot flew into a telephone pole. So there hasn't been any fatalities if you're talking about the seriousness of what's going on here. According to your 2001, there were 64 illnesses reported due to agricultural pesticide, 9 agriculture workers, 55 other people who were infected who did not work in agriculture. I mean, so when we're talking about pesticide, I mean, we've got a lot of information here, and you've already handed it out. And I mean, we're gonna, one of our big budget issues is going to be this Pesticide Reporting Act. I'm going to argue you've got a lot of information. You get it from several different agencies also. You get it from Poison Center Control. I mean, I think we're looking for a problem in search of a solution. Or how am I saying that right?
I know where you're going, but I'm not sure you said it right. But I know where you're going.
I'm getting my point across.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, the report that you're referring to is the Pesticide Analytical Response Center report, which that program, the staffing was not funded during the last legislative session.
So we don't have a report.
So we don't really have as good of a mechanism to follow up on those kinds of reports as we did in the past. And we have a package. The PERS and PARC package would fund both pesticide use reporting and reestablish the Pesticide Analytical Response Center. So that's a place where if we get complaints due to illness, it goes there. The pesticide-based program would be complaints such as drift, or the applicator was not licensed, or the license had expired, or used the wrong product, or the product hadn't been registered. Am I getting that right, too? So there are various components within our pesticide division that we use to make sure that pesticides are used properly in the state by not just agricultural users, but by anyone who uses a pesticide.
A component that's within the Department of Human Services and what that does?
Madam Chair, within Human Services, they look at potential pesticide poisonings as they relate to the workplace. We would receive complaints, just to add to Director Koba's response, of potential pesticide poisonings from individuals. They may call us about them, or they may call the Poison Control Center, and they could be referred back to us. But if it's through the workplace or coming in from, I believe it's a medical provider, those typically go to health services.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I'm trying to get in my mind here, and maybe you can help me, is we're looking at kind of two things with pesticide use. One is acute illnesses caused by using misuse, it sounds like, and that's hopefully with the kind of programs you got is pretty rare. I mean, even with 300 complaints, my sense is from what we're reading here, they're not really, it's rare to have an acute problem. I mean, in medical school, the famous case of the one up in Spokane where the kids got sprayed and they all had convulsions, and that was 30 years ago, and that was a long time passed before that kind of stuff's allowed again. The other concern is long term low grade toxicity of pesticides. And you know, are we building them up in our soil? Are we building them up in our watersheds? You know, what's really happening long term with this? And that's a sort of a different question to be asked, and probably hasn't, and is very difficult to monitor. So when we have the further discussion about pesticide use reporting, I think I'm not going to be quite so concerned about sudden acute stuff as long term effects, and that's something maybe we can't really put a good handle to. But
well,
I appreciate the work you've done.
I would submit that there also are ongoing monitoring programs that monitor water quality issues and those kinds of things to take that issue into account.
There may well be. We'll have that discussion.
Let's, Representative Shaw.
Just a comment. And
you know, I agonized over PERS 2 years ago. Can't we call this PEERS instead of PERS?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, we always refer to it as baby PERS.
Okay.
This could be a lot easier to handle than the other one.
A little less money.
Moving ahead here.
In terms of budget drivers, key issues, and environmental factors for this program area, EPA product registrations and labeling actions, obviously we are carrying out federal law, and federal court decisions which limit where and how pesticide products can be used, and making sure that the industry is aware of that and using pesticides properly, as well as trying to make sure that there are tools available for the industry in terms of their production.
So is this something that is constantly, there are revisions that come through on a regular basis in terms of how things can be used and how they can be applied?
Madam Chair, I'll take a stab at it, and an expert may have to add to it. One example would be products are dropped. You may drop a pesticide for use on broccoli. You used it on broccoli in the past, and it's not registered for broccoli again. So we would be the ones to make sure that the industry is aware of that and not using a product where it may have been able to use it in the past. The same if a new product is registered, then we would work with the industry on that. Or you may have products registered at the national level for use on another crop. It's not registered for broccoli. We have the ability to request a special, I think it's a Section 18, request to go through and analyze whether that product is indeed safe on broccoli, because we think it would be a good tool to use in our state. So those kinds of things, a lot of the work that we do. There was the recent court case in Washington that limited certain kinds of pesticides that could be used at certain distances from water until a review process went through to make sure that it was indeed safe for fish. So we got a lot of information out to the industry in terms of what they could or could not use and what streams they could or could not use it on. So those would be is that a pretty good summary? I'm missing anything.
So for those federally registered pesticide products, is there a body of regulation around regulating who applies them and how they're applied already?
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Assistant Director. Madam Chair, yes, there is regulation about what products can be used by what category of people. General use products, which tend to be the less toxic products, are, I refer to them as over-the-counter. You can pick them up at Home Depot. Households can buy them. Restricted use products are the more toxic products that have more potential health or environmental hazards. Those are only sold to licensed pesticide applicators and operators.
Representative Krieger was first, and then Representative Schaffler, then Senator Nelson.
Pesticides, that includes herbicides and fungicides in the definition?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, it includes any of the sides that kill things, basically. So you can go through an entire list. Rodenticides are part of the list of pesticides. Pesticide is just the broad category name for a very large grouping of products.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I got some information from the guy that came and sprayed around our house and in our house for carpenter ants. He told me that the stuff he was using was actually safer for the environment than the stuff that I bought off the counter at the store. So it's possible that there's some kind of conflict there. I'm sure he's allowed to and authorized to use a lot stronger stuff than I can buy off the counter. But just because he's authorized doesn't necessarily mean what they're using is of greater toxicity than what I can purchase off the shelf. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I believe so, and I'm looking for a nod to confirm this.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
If you can provide the panel a copy of the test that you require applicators to pass when they have to apply restricted use pesticides.
Can we do that? Provide them a copy of the test?
Could you answer?
Oh. Copy of the test that you have to, an applicator has to pass in order to be able to apply restricted use applicants.
Yeah. Are you looking for another line of work, Senator?
Well, I might start drinking.
We need your help. Don't do that. We're in trouble this morning.
Representative Morgan, Senator Nelson, I hear yes in the background. Typically, we try to keep the test confidential, but we definitely could provide you examples of the types of questions,
I mean,
if that would be adequate.
What I'm looking for is that basically, I mean, we talk about pesticides, but somebody's got to apply it, and they better know what they're doing. And in order to apply it, not just everybody can apply it. In fact, I know of a lot of farmers that they just hire none because it's a very complicated test. I can't pass it, so I mean, I hire my none. You see,
is there any way that you could make us aware of the scope of the test and the scope of the knowledge that you have to have without breaching the confidentiality issues?
Representative Morgan, absolutely. I'll go back and work with staff to put together.
Thank you.
A packet
Chair,
of information.
I'd be happy to offer up my test. If you want to go find it out of the file, you can use my test.
Did you pass?
Oh, of course. I always pass. I may not pass at the level I'd like to.
I destroy your argument.
I will say this. It has gotten more complicated. It's become a more difficult test than it used to be. And today, you can attend a number of trainings every year to be updated on the latest issues so that you don't have to go back and take the test every few years. But if you don't attain the hours that you need in the recertification process over a period of 5 years, then you have to go take the test. You're welcome to use my test. I don't mind.
I do think it would be interesting for the committee to kind of get a look at what the field is there around restricted.
The field?
Restricted application pesticides, what's involved in the testing and continued qualification for licensure. Senator.
Thank you. There's still the issue of compliance. I'm glad we have a good program for testing people and qualifying people to use this, and I was partially aware of that before this committee met, but I've learned more, I've gone along, and I appreciate what you're doing. There's always a problem of compliance no matter what we're doing, no matter what field we're in. Many of us still feel that some form of reporting system is going to be necessary. You don't know what you're going to find when you measure something if you don't start measuring it. And that's one of the situations we're in here now. And how you measure it is going to be a key question, too. So this is going to be something we're going to talk about more before this committee gets out of this building. And I want people to understand that I'm aware of a lot of what goes on. I'm willing to learn more. But many people feel that pesticide use reporting is something this state needs to start doing in some way, shape, or form. And that's open to question what it should be, what it should look like, how it's done. But we need to do this. And compliance has got to be an issue in this somewhere along the line.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we attempt to get at compliance through our base program. I don't believe compliance is part of the pesticide use reporting system. That's not what it would be used for.
Madam Chair, let me follow up. If someone's not complying with what they've been taught is the best practices, and nobody complains to you about them, you won't know what they're doing. How else would you find out that we have an excess of pesticide being applied in a certain area if we're not finding some way of trying to measure that in the environment?
Representative Morgan and Senator Bates, I would contend that the pesticide use reporting system is likely not going to get us to that answer either, because if they are misusing the pesticides, likely they're not going to report it into the system either.
Thank you.
It's kind of like if we had one doctor issuing all the medical marijuana cards.
We actually had that. we had to get them under control.
Director Kolba has some folks here that are on rather tight timelines and wish to put some public testimony into the record. Do you wish to bring those people forward at this time?
I'm not sure he wants to come up now. But, Madam Chair, the public testimony for our budget is scheduled for tomorrow, and we had one individual who could not make it tomorrow and wanted to come and provide some public testimony today. So Rick Jacobson, who is the CEO for Norpak Foods, is here. And Rick, would you like to come up and testify? Good afternoon, and thank you for taking your time to come and speak with us today.
Thank you. It was difficult to break away from my busy schedule as I just returned from Jamaica. So we start from on a positive note. As Katie says, my name is Rick Jacobs. I'm the CEO and president of Norpak Foods. I think it's important for me to point out that I'm here today because of the importance to Norpak of ODA and that relationship between ourselves and the guidance that the director, my fellow Pendletonian, she's been really important in some of the strategies that Norpak has in terms of what we have to do to compete in the global economy. Time doesn't allow me today to really give you a full detailed description of Norpak Foods, but I think a backgrounder might be helpful. Norpak, as you may know, is a processing and marketing cooperative. We're owned by 240 family farmers that farm in the Willamette Valley and the Tualatin Valley. They produce 25 different crops of fruits and vegetables that are frozen and canned and shipped throughout the United States, Canada, Pacific Rim, Puerto Rico, and some parts of Europe. We sell into every market segment of the food business, both as a branded supplier and a private label supplier. As some of you know, our business strategy for the last 40 years is focused on value-added products. Today, which I don't usually talk about, I would tell you that 35% of our total sales portfolio is based on value-added sales. Hopefully, and this is a commercial, you would know us better as Flavor Pack Fruits and Vegetables or Sandy Am Canned Vegetables. It's important for you to know, I think, that we've been in business since 1924, with our corporate headquarters remaining in Staten, Oregon. For the most part, the cooperative membership is made up of second and third, mostly third generation farmers who all support their communities. It's for kind of a benchmark, we were just recently rated in an industry publication as one of the top 10 frozen fruit and vegetable processors in the United States. I would say if we were rated on the basis of quality, we would be number one. There's no prejudice there or bias. I think the background is important because of the unique characteristics of our cooperative. The owners are farmers. They own the land that the crops are produced on for Norpak, with our mission at the cooperative being to provide a reliable and stable marketplace, both nationally and internationally, for those crops. That's different than you might see in a publicly traded company. It means we have to make different decisions in order to stay in those markets. The point I wanted to make as we talk about the issues of certification is that we're not going to move our production elsewhere. Our charge is to find ways to compete and maintain a market for our farmers. I think that's good for Oregon, and the fact that Oregon has an international company that's going to do all it can to do to stay in business in the state of Oregon. Now, with that background in mind, I think we all recognize that Norpak is not and will not be a low-cost producer. We are not going to shift our production to other countries where labor is cheaper and the infrastructure is cheaper. We must find a way to compete by distinguishing ourselves from others. Value added has been one of our strengths, but that alone is not going to determine our future. The challenge that I think we have is to differentiate ourselves from a discerning public. a public that's concerned about how the product is produced and marketed. Is it environmentally and socially acceptable? And if so, how do we tell that story? That's where the ODA comes to the forefront. With their help, encouragement, and advice, the grower members of NORPAC have developed the NORPAC stewardship guidelines that deal with four specific areas and components of responsible farming practices: disease and pest management, soil and water conservation, fish and wildlife, and fair and safe working conditions for farm workers. Through a collaboration with a public and private partnership with the ODA, OSU, the Oregon Economic Community Development Department, and the Food Alliance, which you may know as a certification group out of Portland for organic farmers, the members of NORPAC have developed a third-party audit process to determine compliance with their stewardship guidelines. The process of beginning, as a matter of fact, certifications are taking place as we speak. I thought you would be interested in hearing that. Additionally, we have, through the Governor's Oregon Solutions Program, been part of developing a program to support the effort of NORPAC members, and it will be known as the Oregon Agricultural Sustainability Resource Center. The center will provide the expertise and the resources by the many agencies that make up the regulatory community of agriculture: Oregon Department of Agriculture, Department of Environmental Quality, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Water Resources, OROSHA, BOLI, OSU, Defenders of Wildlife, Natural Resource Conservation Service. The list is long, and I'm excited about that. It's going to develop a great resource for growers to go to get help through the certification process. And I think that's something that's important for the committee to understand, that there is a resource that growers can go to get the expertise and the financial resources, if necessary, to address issues of fish screening, if that happens to be what it is. And I think it's important because NORPAC has, for a variety of reasons, taken a lead on this, that it doesn't just apply to us. I don't think I was going to be successful in getting state agencies to do only something for NORPAC. Not that I wouldn't try that. But this is truly a marketing issue for Oregon products. Recently, Sysco, which is the largest food service distributor in the United States, issued their own Sysco Sustainability Initiative. And it's going to require certification of growers of all of their fruit and vegetable suppliers. That's in place. Many folks have been to some of their sessions to determine what the next steps are. I'd like to tell you that I'm very pleased that NORPAC exceeded their criteria with our initiative, and no small amount of credit goes to the ODA for their support in helping us develop these guidelines. As the director knows, one of my lofty goals is to see eventually an Oregon State seal on our products that identifies that the product was produced in an environmentally and socially responsible way and grown in Oregon. I think that's an edge that we can use, and that it's met the rigorous certification requirements of a third-party audit. This is one way a company like NORPAC that's committed to Oregon can distinguish itself from imported product that has the advantage of significantly lower costs. It's something that Oregon, I think, must do if we are to compete in a dynamic global marketplace. As I wrap up my comments, I would like to say publicly again and thank the governor for his support by endorsing, through his Oregon Solutions Plan, this effort on the Oregon Ag Sustainability Resource Center. It's really getting legs under it, and it's going to be housed at OSU. And we're in the process of making sure that we all put some seed money into it, which will require some dollars out of NORPAC's hard-earned money to help support that. I think also, I would be remiss with not saying thank you to Marty Brantley, too. The Oregon Economic Community Development Department awarded a grant of $50,000 to NORPAC to support the development of our certification program. And again, to Katie for her encouragement on this and the support of our efforts to develop a certification program. I think it's important, as you look at the market forces in the United States and overseas, that third-party certification is going to be a critical component to our long-term viability of our company, and I really believe it for our industry. a certification program under the direction of the ODA will be it will be good for Oregon, and I certainly hope that you find this initiative that we've undertaken support for the certification program that Katie's been talking to you about. And I'd leave it open for any questions.
Questions or comments from the committee members? Senator Nelson?
Several things, I guess. I don't know if I can put them.
Jamaica.
Yeah. I'm sorry you're here. No, you're talking about public-private partnership is for the third-party certification. Okay, so what is the extent of, how can we help you and how can we harm you by doing something at the government level? And we're talking about, is government going to solve all these problems? You're basically saying no. What are the things that hurt you? What are the things that help you? And what would you ask this legislature to do beyond this, what you're saying here?
Well, there's several components. Senator Nelson, I make sure I say that right. The first is certification. NORPAC's undertaken a public-private partnership with Food Alliance as a third-party auditor right now. Long-term, if the ODA is geared up and it develops over time, the credibility in the marketplace as being a good certification group, I think that's helpful. I think it's helpful to the industry in Oregon, and I think it's helpful to Oregon. You know, we're looked at across this country right now as a green state. Why not use that? Why not have a rigorous certification process to where at the end of the day, a flavor pack product may have a state of Oregon seal on it with owned by farmers, grown in Oregon, and sustainable. And it's if you look at the fact that our initiative was put together, it was put together with the help of the ODA, Food Alliance, Oregon State, and the growers. And they developed their own guidelines, which are pretty rigorous, probably more so than what would be done at the state level. And they've done that simply because it's important for them to communicate to their customers that we do things the right way, and we're willing to lay it out and say we'll have a third-party auditor certify that. And they're paying for it, and they're doing it. That's the certification process. With fairness, consistency, I think is going to be very helpful to Oregon agriculture long term, particularly the industry that we're in. When you sell things that people eat, companies like Sysco, U.S. Food Service, Albertsons, Costco, Sam's Club are going to say, how do you grow this product, and are you doing it responsibly? And if we can have it certified at a state agency, I think it's going to happen. Are we going to be there first?
Representative Shelton.
Yeah, and then this certification process you're talking about for NORDPAC right now, that'll be recognized overseas by the Europeans and the Japanese, for example?
We haven't done any Eurogap. I think it's equal to Eurogap. It's not as much paperwork. It's on the ground, what's really going on. It works fine in Japan. We've been in Japan for 30 years, 40 years. So it's going to exceed their demands. It has not been an easy undertaking. It's been 3 years in the making. And it's designed by growers, which is the good news, because they've put it in the position of being a continuous improvement. There's a certain level that they have to exceed in order to be certified, and then each year the bar starts raising. And, it deals with an awful lot of issues, I think, that the public is interested in.
Senator Nelson,
yes.
You have a follow-up?
Yeah, I'm just trying to. There are some barriers to success of your industry in this state. What should we be doing to legislate? Can we harm you? Can we help you?
You keep asking me that.
Yeah, I'm just telling you that there's some things that we do that could be detrimental to what you're doing.
There's a host of things that the legislature can do to be detrimental to an industry. I think we know that. One only has to look at what's happened to our industry over the last 5 to 7 years in terms of failures. Is that all the state's fault? Certainly not. Did the state contribute to it? Maybe. But it's market forces that impact a company like ours more than maybe the state can do to us. And Senator, you know, I think for a company like ours, and it's no secret, we've been through some really tough times, and we came out the other side okay. And we're going to continue to be okay because we're locked in the ground here in the Willamette Valley. But I think our company has taken a different view. What do we have to do to engage the public agencies to help us be successful? And I think if you sat in on the what's now known as OSARC, the Oregon Ag Sustainability Research, you would be surprised at the enthusiasm on the part of most of the agencies that, hey, this isn't about regulating, this is about providing resources, and it's about providing expertise to help people get where they want to go. I think it's a different mindset, one that, born and raised in Eastern Oregon, took a while to make that change.
Yeah, it's a little different. Just follow up. I mean, so do you think market forces will take care of this whole problem? I mean, you either answer to the market.
We got to understand. This is hard to understand. You know, when you're indexing minimum wage to the urban areas, we're going to be competing against countries that are paying $5 a day. And that's the reality of it. You know, we do some business in Mexico, and we know that, you know, we go down there and they're harvesting broccoli, which we grow here in the valley. They're paying these guys $5 a day. Our growers are paying probably on the average $9.30, $9.60 an hour to get the same crop. So what do? We mechanize. We find ways to mechanize in the field, to mechanize in the plants. It's our job to find a way to compete in that market. There are times when you have issues such as, and I'll use that as the anecdotal answer, when you have a minimum wage that's being indexed to that extent in an urban area at the farm level, that's not going to work long term. And one of the disconnects I think that the general public has is, why would companies like Truett's and Sabroso and Norpac and Smith's get all these revaluations of their property tax? Because our businesses are devalued. Because we, you know, guys are losing money going out of business. So I think from a standpoint of what the legislature can do is they can look at what can we do to support agriculture. Now, is that if the public policy is going to be index the minimum wage, and you're going to put more of a burden on a company that has to compete globally against something other than that, then is it a bad idea to find some way to provide a tax credit to offset that public policy decision? Because the wages are being set by somebody else, so help them. Those are the kind of things I think the legislature can do. But I don't see that as my charge today, is to provide all the solutions. But I think to be sensitive to a difficult business we're in. We're in a commodity business, and that's why we've moved 35% of it towards value-added.
Thank you so much. Very interesting comments. We appreciate your time.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Coburn,
I'm determined to get through the agency today, so we'll move along. Back to the pesticides division, and this is the last major division to go through in terms of key issues. I'd already mentioned access to pest control products for specialty crop growers. Again, homeland security in this area is a concern. And finally, the complexity of implementing a pesticide use reporting system. Even if the system is funded, the challenge of actually upgrading the software, taking it off the shelf, dusting it off, bringing it up to speed, getting out to growers and getting them using the system is going to be a challenge for us. Very quickly, our administration and business services includes the director's office as well, provides overall agency leadership, policy development, analysis, and administration for the agency, our financial management, personnel management, all of those things inherent in an administration division. Key issues for us are increasing agency responsibilities and complexity of issues, and hopefully you got a sense of that as I've gone through kind of the programs and the key issues we're dealing with. Certainly, the demand to use technology in the work that we do is incredible, and just making sure we do that prudently, efficiently, effectively is a challenge for us. And our ability to recruit and retain a highly skilled workforce, dealing with retirements, a lot of turnover in our agency really for the first time in a long time. So that's been a challenge for us, but something that we think we're up to. So to summarize, for the agency-wide, key budgetary issues for us, obviously our food safety program funding issue, the pesticide use reporting system, the Ag Development and Marketing Division certification package, and the renewable energy position that is in that package, and I'll go into more detail on that in a minute. Funding for our threatened and endangered plant program, and just working to make sure that we've got enough flexibility in our other funds programs to deal with some of the unpredictable elements of the work in our agency. We've seen a tightening up in terms of other funds limitation. We want to make sure we're at the right spot and we haven't gone too far, and we're having lots of conversations with Paul, and I will get there one way or the other. Very quickly then, I wanted to go through the key budget packages in our agency. We spent a lot of time on this package last Thursday, the food safety package. The governor's budget restores the general fund support in that package at $1 million, a little over $1 million. In this current biennium, we're at $428,000 of general fund for that program. So right now we're at about 5% of general fund support for the program. If we went to the governor's recommended budget level, we're going to be roughly a little over 10%. Comparing that to, we were at 30% general fund support prior to our budget challenges a few years ago. Again, just a reminder that the package itself is short the $979,695 in expenditure authority to fully fund a program of roughly $9.8 million. Paul is aware of that. Certainly Christine is, and as we go through and decide what the funding makeup is going to be in that package, we're going to have to work to make sure that technically we put it together correctly. It could be a little bit complicated. We have a bill that would raise fees. The governor's recommended budget, even with the $1 million in general fund restored, would still require a fee increase in the range of 85 to 90% to fully fund the program. We have a package request in that would provide us one position funded with federal funds to continue our participation in developing the National Livestock Identification System. We spent a lot of time today talking about that. Again, these are federal funds, one position, and we would continue implementation here in the state of Oregon. And we also have a request in for one position. This would be a bioterrorism coordinator for the agency. The fund source is actually federal funds, but they flow through the Human Services Agency, and so they come to us as other funds. We have two positions currently in the agency that are limited duration positions for our work with the Sudden Oak Death Program. This package would make those positions permanent, and the funding is a combination of other funds from license fees and federal funds. The governor included in his recommended budget restoring the general fund support for the threatened and endangered plant program. This would be $242,000 plus in general fund and two positions to, again, manage that program. We conduct statutorily mandated survey and project reviews for state and local agencies. We respond to petitions for the listing or delisting of native plant species. We conduct permit consultations with the federal government and then conduct reviews of the conservation status of species currently listed to see if they need to continue to be protected.
Is the federal fund component contingent on a general fund match?
Madam Chair, the federal funds are actually grants, federal grants that we go after to work on specific species. So the federal funding in this program does not meet, we cannot use the federal funds to do the just the survey work, the general listing, delisting. The federal funds are only available for a grant request that we would put in for work on a certain particular species. We would, if the general fund was restored, we would continue to go after federal fund grant opportunities as they came up. But we cannot use the federal funds to run the state program.
So what, give us, I guess, a better idea of what the general fund component actually covers in the program.
It covers everything that's listed under that second bullet, and that is all done by the general fund. So it's basically, we may get a request for a listing from a group. We would need to go out and conduct an analysis to see if the plant actually does meet listing requirements. That is done by general funds. Just our own ongoing knowledge and understanding in terms of plant species that are out there, the plants that we're monitoring, making sure they're established and healthy. The goal is to take them off the threatened and endangered plant list. That's all general fund activity and not federal fund activity.
And in the current biennium, how is this funded right now?
Madam Chair, we are currently not doing those elements. We are going after federal funds to do species-specific work. We also were paid by the Economic and Community Development Department to go out and do plant species review on industrial land sites as part of the industrial land certification program. But we're not doing the standard work required under the statute.
Then if we haven't been doing it, what is the argument? Why should we start doing this now? I mean, given that we have some pretty dire financial circumstances in the state and have some huge funding needs in the education, human service, and public safety sector, why is this a good investment for the taxpayers of the state of Oregon at this time?
Madam Chair, I would say that the program has basically not been funded for a year and a half now. It's not, we haven't lost our expertise in terms of our staff person that does this work. We're not far behind in terms of the work that we were doing and can immediately pick up, back up, and get the program going again if it's funded. I think if we wait much longer, then we're going to have a hard time getting back up to speed in a quick manner. And I would also make the case that under $250,000 of general fund is a pretty small investment when you're dealing with the potential of losing threatened and endangered plant species because we're not doing the work that's needed to be done. Another concern that we have is someone could bring suit against the state for not conducting this work and the cost to either handle that lawsuit and the potential cost that we may pay could be much greater than $250,000 in general fund.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schaffler.
The reduction in other funds and federal funds, is that relative to the revised budget compared to last biennium? Or is that what you're suggesting? And if we put the 242 in, will you be able to fill them up with the grants you would seek? Can you kind of explain that to me? Or if you can just get the information from here, I'm going to have to do it now. No run-out
guns. Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffler. For the record, Christina Shearer, Department of Administrative Services. In the prior biennium, this program was defunded with general fund. At that time, federal funds were increased for this program in anticipation that the agency would be more aggressive in seeking federal funding to do those plant-specific surveys. What the agency is trying to do is return back to their level, their funding balance that they had prior to that defunding. Is that a correct statement? Okay, I wanted to make sure I didn't misstate there.
That's everything.
Sure. I thought we couldn't use those federal funds to do the program.
It was just a shift to more emphasize these plant-specific surveys that the federal government would pay for. They did cease doing the state-specific program, yeah, because of the general fund. They just shifted their attention to federally funded activities. Does that make sense?
Representative or Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a very small budget. I'm trying to figure it out very quickly. I'm still a little vague on what the federal programs do versus what the state program does, and how it was intermingled. It looks like your entire federal funds is only $500,000 or $600,000, and this looks like you're losing half of that. And then, so the general fund is sort of keeps you where you were total budget-wise. But what are you doing that's different? Madam Chair, is that what you're trying to get to? Also, I couldn't sift that out from your answers.
Well, what I got from it was that the federal funds were actually grants to do very specific on-the-ground things, whereas the general fund was more to do the survey and manage kind of stuff and respond to requests for listings.
Madam Chair, for the record, Chuck Craig, Deputy Director for the Department. I'll take a swing at answering it. Under the state's threatened and endangered species law, the department has a series of functions and duties that Katie explained. Then part of what we do is designed to prevent future federal listings by being proactive in understanding the status of rare plants in the state. So we study the status of those and we list them in order to provide sort of an advanced degree of conservation before they become federally listed, because if they become federally listed, you start to run into problems where they really can have a significant economic impact. So what we did essentially in order to keep the people employed and keep the program resources intact was to allow the program to obtain as much federal grant money as it could to work on these very specific projects that had to do with just federally listed species. And so the functions that we were doing that had to do with consultation with other agencies and so on like that, we just ceased to continue doing that, and we allowed the people the expertise that we had to survive on federal grant money.
There, within the Department of State Lands, there is right now an advisory committee that does endangered plant listings for the state of Oregon, and we've moved actually the catalog or the database of endangered plants to the Natural Resource Institute at Oregon State University. How does that relate to this program?
Madam Chair, I think you might be referring to the Natural Heritage Program. And that is actually sort of a confidential list of sites that where rare plants exist. It's not a regulatory program, and the Division of State Lands doesn't have any regulatory authority. But historically, they and they actually we've been partners with them in that program. But historically, they had that Natural Heritage Program, which is a compilation of sites where rare plants exist within the state.
So how would that be different from your survey and project, your you having to survey? I mean, what my understanding is that they have a board now that's within the department that nominates things to be included in the database that are threatened or endangered, and so the database maps where they are in the state of Oregon. How is this different than that?
Well, it's essentially a database of sites, but it doesn't, from the overall standpoint of researching the factors that may be contributing to the decline of a species. It doesn't really analyze that in terms of how do you conserve it, what is the likelihood that it will survive if you don't do anything. It's more of a database. And we historically have actually contributed financially to the maintenance of that. I don't know what the status of it is right now because I've been away from it for a while. But it's not a program that actually studies the status of the plant and tries to determine scientifically whether they're going to make it or not if they're not listed.
So is this a situation where there would be federal funding available in the form of grants for the kinds of things that were identified by the Natural Heritage database, and you could get federal grant funds to actually do the work on what would it take to restore the things that were listed there?
I hesitate to say that you couldn't, but the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife has a process for approving state programs, and the Department of Ag has approved state programs. And much of the money that comes to the state flows through Section 6 of the Federal Threatened and Endangered Species Act, and you have to be an approved state program, I believe, to access those funds. So I wouldn't say that you could never get any federal funds to do that work, but the more direct route would certainly be for funds to come to our program for that sort of work, or to go to other federal agencies that are land-owning agencies that have those listed species on their land.
And Madam Chair, Christina also clarified that Department of State Lands doesn't have plant biologists on staff. This is okay. That she doesn't believe they do, and I certainly don't know if they do or not. And it's just more of just kind of a registry. It's a list, but beyond that, they don't really do anything with it.
Yeah.
Representative Shaw.
I understand the animals that we have listed on our state Endangered Species Act don't perfectly overlap with the federal government's list. Is that true for plants, too?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, that's true. There are,
is it a great
I think,
difference?
17 or 18 federally listed plant species in Oregon, and there are 58 state-listed species.
Let's go quickly and see if we can get the other policy option packages done in the next 6 minutes.
We can do it. The next package is the package to fund the Pesticide Analytical Response Center and the Pesticide Use Reporting System, as well as the outreach efforts with the Pesticide Use Reporting System. The Pesticide Use Reporting System would be funded equally with general fund and other fund in the governor's recommended budget, as is required by statute. And then the remainder of the general fund is the support for the Pesticide Analytical Response Center. Package 400 is the Ag Development and Marketing Division Certification Specialist and Renewable Energy Specialist package. It provides two positions that would work on the certification technical assistance. And again, we view these as individuals that would work with the industry, with processors, with folks who are interested in taking advantage of an existing certification program and maybe need help understanding what's out there, what are the myriad of programs, given their product, given their market mix, what should they be taking advantage of, providing them the assistance in terms of what kind of documentation they would need to have ready to go if they actually had someone come in and conduct an audit. We could help them in terms of their practices and how close they are to meeting the standards and what they might need to put in place to help those, help meet those standards. In addition, we believe we need someone working with the market side to try to convince the marketplace that this certification program shouldn't be different from Safeway's, from Albertson's, from Fred Meyer's, because it presents such a hurdle of programs that the industry would need to gear up for. And if we could try to get some kind of standardization across the marketplace, we think that would be of great benefit to the industry. And then the second part of the package would be one person that would be the agency's person dealing with all of the opportunities we believe are out there around renewable energy. Okay. So very quickly, here's an overview diagram of the key packages in our budget that we just went through. Again, quickly, cost containment actions that we've put in place, and these are things I would say that we just don't do on a one-time basis, but that we're continually looking for ways to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of what we do and how we do it. We've conducted an extensive review of all administrative rules. As a result of that review, several were amended or repealed. Constantly looking at the opportunities around statewide use of technology systems, because we have so many staff that are out in the field and where we can employ technology to help them do their job. An example of technology, again, with a marketing teleconference product shows with buyers in Korea and Japan. We do the show here and telemarket it to them there, so we don't have to travel or have folks in the industry travel and have that cost. Working on developing, we do have online forms and applications for services, and hopefully we'll be able to soon allow online paying for permits, licenses. A customer-assisted inspection program in our shipping point program that's, again, that notion of the third-party audit, whereby we train them in terms of process, and then we come in and audit them to make sure they're complying with requirements. I had mentioned before our pilot program for using inmate labor in our shipping point program. Obviously, always looking for collaborative arrangements with other state and federal agencies to provide the services that are provided for the industry. Looking at eliminating or reducing certain activities, and we did that primarily in our food safety program. We are in the midst of a consolidated licensing pilot program whereby we would look for a single license for a convenience store that currently has to get a license from us, DEQ, multiple agencies that they currently have to get licenses from, allow them to do one license, and then we would divvy out the income to the appropriate agencies. We have been and will continue to conduct comprehensive review of our laboratory structure costs and our emergency response capabilities, making sure we're able to do the things that we need to do and doing it in a way that's cost-friendly to the industry. And we do have field staff strategically located around the state. Many of them are based out of their homes. Their office is basically a vehicle. It's a good way to cut down on costs for us. Agency legislation, I won't go through this. You can read that at your leisure.
Thank you,
Madam Chair, that's it.
Questions or comments? Representative Shelf.
Thanks. We talked that we have a bill in business labor combining OLCC and lottery. I'd imagine some of these stores have lottery and OLCC permits, too. Would you be bundling all that together? I would hope you would. And let them get it online, too.
And I'm sure I'll have Lauren Henderson, who is our
administrator
of our administrative services division, speak very quickly to that.
For the record, Lauren Henderson, Administrative Services. We're currently working with DCBS and the governor's office on the pilot program to combine in a Venn diagram what ODA's licenses with OLCC and DEQ, because those were the ones that were common among those three agencies for the pilot program. There's 55 participants that have opted in and will be going issuing those licenses as soon as that legislation is approved.
Good. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we also had House Bill 5004, which was a ratification of the agency's fees. I don't know if we want to try to do that tomorrow.
We're out of time.
Yes. And so then we provided a response to the question you had in terms of what were the 10 CDC risk factors, so you have that in front of you.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 5003 and 5004, and we will adjourn this hearing unless you had some announcements. And we'll reconvene tomorrow to finish consideration on the fee bill and take public testimony.